Well, the days of unleavened bread picture a journey that all followers of Christ are on. In many respects, today pictures the end game. We don't often think of it because we always think of the feast and sort of the finality of the plan of God. But today, in many respects, again, if this is the picture of our life, it's the last day. And if you think about it, many of us will not be here on the day Christ returns. How many thousands of followers of God are not here? Yet this time pictures the totality of our walk. Some have been here for a long time. Some are new. But it is a journey from the enslavement and darkness of Satan's system to a free family member in the kingdom of God. It's our journey. It's our story. And like Israel, God guides us. He is there. He is always there. They had a pillar, a fire, and a cloud to watch. As we heard in the offertory, we have that same pillar within us. And He is always there. But, like Israel, we too face many perils. We face many dangers in our journey. I started this message by contemplating a question in my head. What's the greatest risk we face as followers of Christ on this journey? And I suppose, depending whether we're just now starting it or we've been in this for 40, 50, 60, maybe 70 years out here, the answer to that question will vary. I can tell you for my own sake, for a long time, for the longest time, I believed that the greatest risk that Christians faced was deception. Being deceived by somebody, somewhere, somehow, some way. We don't need to turn there, but Mark 13:22 talks about it. It says, "For false Christs and false prophets will rise and show signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, the elect." Now again, we get take some confidence and courage in that it says, "if possible." But there is a great deception that will come and is upon us and is in Christianity, if you will, already. Revelation 3:11, this is regarding the Philadelphian era of the church. It says, "Let no one take your crown," implying it can happen. And I suspect if we hold to the belief, which I think there's ample evidence again to support, that you know, Mr. Armstrong and the work we did in Worldwide and he did sort of typifies the Philadelphian era. And how many people let somebody come and take their crown? Again, deception. They weren't dishonest in it. They thought they were doing the right thing. But somebody took their crown. So again, this concept of deception. Someone else coming along. This is what I sort of thought. You know, we've got to be on guard for this. I've grown up in the church. Every so many years, there's somebody that comes along and they go do their thing. They, you know, people come, people go. And usually there's somebody that's whispering something in their ear. So again, this is what I've historically viewed. I've come to change my mind a little bit on it. Over the last several years, more specifically and very much from an introspective perspective, I've come to believe that it's something different. I think it's still deception, but I think it's deception that goes on in here. About my own state and our own state, our own position, if you will, as a member, a potential, and a on-the-road member, on a journey, if you will, family member of God. Because I know I do, and I suspect we all do, because again, you just have to watch what they do. And you know, people have convinced themselves they are simply right. We're simply right, whether it's true or not. We just convince ourselves that we're right. We have these conversations in our head. We justify things. And in doing so, we are deceiving ourselves. If you think about it, every sin we commit, there is some level of deception in our head. Because at some point you said, it's okay. It's okay to have that next drink. It's okay to lie in this case. It's okay to take that and steal it. We've justified it. We've made it okay in our head. Even if 2 days later we regret it and we're tearfully before God saying, I wish I hadn't done that. It's all in here. We had that conversation. We made it okay. We simply don't do what isn't okay in our head. It's not within us. Both of these, I do believe, are real and tangible dangers on our journey. And as I mentioned, I think the second one is perhaps the greater one. And we'll talk about that as the message goes on. But I do want to make one point before I sort of leave these. Because the core of the message today isn't about deception. Because in both of these, the greatest risk, if you will, brought to these dangers that I would say compounds this on an exponential scale is if we don't believe it can happen. If we don't acknowledge that this could happen, we are doomed to resting secure where we are. If we don't acknowledge that we might have wrong behaviors, we might have wrong thoughts, that our opinion of ourselves may not be shared with God, then we're simply going to stay where we are and we'll go no further. We will simply sit secure in our own belief of where we are. And we will not look to another source. We will not look to the source of Christ for a true vision and a true understanding of who and what and where we are. A well-known prophecy, so we don't even have to turn there. If I give you some may know it just based upon where it's located. Proverbs 21:2. Some of you may have that memorized. But I know if I give you the first couple words, everybody here can finish it. Every way of a man is right. It's a proverb. Every way of a man is right in his own eyes. It's either true or not. We could say, well, that's true of everybody else, but not me. No, it says every way of a man. Every way. Second half of this is equally important. But the Lord weighs the heart. I want to take a look at a couple examples. These are examples we use repeatedly, but they are so instructive. It's hard to get away from them. We have a lot of details on these people's lives. And as a result, we have a lot of lessons to learn out of them. Saul, if you want, we will read this. 1 Samuel chapter 13. Saul, again, just to preface, because we're going to break into the story here a little bit, he was a man handpicked by God. This is not some schlep that came in off the streets and sort of by force took over and, you know, enslaved Israel and said, "You're going to follow me with a heavy hand." He was picked by God, accepted by the nation. God said that I'm going to turn you into another man. This is actually back in chapter 10. And Samuel saying, God's with you. God gave you another heart. He touched his heart. These are all phrases that are talked about regarding Saul as he was selected and put over the nation of Israel. So again, this is not somebody, again, that's a tyrannical dictator when he starts out, at least. So I want to pick it up again. We're breaking quite heavily into the story. But 1 Samuel chapter 13, we'll start in verse 5. It says, then the Philistines gathered together to fight with Israel, 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen and people as the sand which is on the shoreline in multitude. And they came up and encamped in Michmash to the east of Beth-Aven. When the men of Israel saw it, they were in danger, for the people were distressed. Then the people hid in caves and thickets and rocks and holes and in pits. And some of the Hebrews crossed over the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. And Saul, he was still in Gilgal. And all the people followed him trembling. Again, we got to sort of put ourselves in this perspective. That's a natural response. There's nothing sort of that we wouldn't all go do. This would be somewhat analogous to, well, let's take a lot of us. I mean, I'm sure there's some people here that maybe boxed when they were young and had their strength in some of the youth. And are we going to go against the National Guard? You know, they're going to come at us. They got tanks and weapons and they're, you know, no, man, we're not. I mean, they were not men of war. So to have this army coming against them, they're, you know, stated and known enemies, this is somewhat of a natural reaction. But here's where the story again, we're going to get into the mind of Saul a little bit. This is where it gets interesting. Then he waited 7 days according to the time set by Samuel. So again, Saul knew that there was a time set by Samuel. Saul was a man of God, essentially. He knew to seek God. He knew to comply. He knew to do these things. So he waited 7 days according to the time set by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him. So Saul's looking at this, and he makes a judgment. He does something in his head that he justified and he made okay. So Saul said. Saul said this. Here it's a quote. So clearly he uttered it verbally, but thoughts come from the heart. He meditated. He thought through this and said, this is what I've got to do. So Saul said, bring a burnt offering and a peace offering here to me. And he offered the burnt offering. So Saul, this is a spiritual act. I've got to do this. I know Samuel said he'll be here and he's got to do it, but you know, look, everybody's running away. I've got to take charge. I've got to go do these things. Saul said this. Now it happened, as soon as he had finished presenting the burnt offering, that Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him, that he might greet him. I find this actually an interesting statement in the light of trying to get in the head of Saul. No shame. No awareness that, you know what? What you just did was really, really wrong. I mean, we get the benefit of sort of knowing the end of the story. But here's Saul coming out, presumably with a smile, greeting him, hugging him, saying, hey, guess what? You know, we're good. No shame, no concern that he overstepped his bounds. And Samuel said, what have you done? It's a good question. Again, as the story goes on, we know Samuel was cued off by God. He said, what have you done? And Saul said, I read this again, without shame of face. Well, you know, when I made it in my head and I saw what was going on, the people were scattered from me. Where's Saul's head? What's going on inside there? When I saw that the people were scattered from me and that you did not come in the days appointed and that the Philistines gathered together at Michmash, then I said... Again, what's in Saul's head? He's justifying his actions. At this point, I don't sense any sort of, again, shame of face or remorse here that maybe, just maybe, he didn't do anything or didn't do something right here. Then I said, the Philistines will now come down on me at Gilgal, me, and I have not made supplication to the Lord. Therefore, I felt compelled. This is my rationale, Samuel. This is what I thought. This is what I was going through. I felt compelled to offer a burnt offering. It's interesting to note too. The justification for this is what? I'm serving the Lord. I'm seeking Him. I'm coming after Him. I'm getting His advice. You can't be bothered by this, are you? Well, again, we get the benefit of knowing the next line of Saul or Samuel. And Samuel said to Saul, you have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which He commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought for Himself a man after His own heart. And the Lord has commanded him to be commander over His people because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. It's a phenomenal in view into the mindset of Saul. And again, this is, you know, we can call this midway through the story. It gets worse. This mindset continues. But again, he's justifying it by a righteous act, by saying it's okay because, well, I'm doing it for the brethren, as we would say today. I'm doing it for the church. I'm doing it for you. What you have done foolishly is the answer. That's God's assessment, by the way. It's not Samuel making it up. That's God's assessment. Jump forward to 1 Samuel chapter 15. In the interim, again, I think many of us, if not all of us, are very well familiar with these stories. But this is where, in between these two events, Jonathan has this bold assault against the Philistine where he takes his armor bearer up there and slays this little little group of Philistines up there. And due to no, just because he didn't get the king's command, he ends up defying the king's command not to eat until they had killed all the Philistines. And so Saul wants to kill him and all this stuff. So there's this big, you know, lot of activity in between all these. But we want to come back to the story where the Lord commanded Saul to go and punish the Amalekites. He says to utterly destroy all that they have done and do not spare them. Again, this is important because this is not something like Saul did not know. He understood. He clearly understood. He reiterates. He knows the commandment of the Lord. So we'll pick the story up in 1 Samuel 15, chapter, or verse 12. So when Samuel rose early in the morning to meet Saul, it was told Samuel, saying, Saul went to Carmel and indeed has set up a monument for himself. I mean, we're picking up right where we left off. He's setting up a monument to who? Himself. And he has gone around and passed by and gone down to Gilgal. Again, it's a little bit of an insight into where his mind is. Then Samuel went to Saul, and Saul said to him, Blessed are you of the Lord. I have performed the commandment of the Lord. Again, no shame of face, no awareness that he did not. Between the command and this statement, he justified his mind. He deceived himself. He made it okay. To the point where he could look the man of God, Samuel, who he knew was a servant of the living God, and say, I have done it. Proactively comes out to meet him. Again, hey buddy, I did it. But Samuel said, What then? What then is this bleating of the sheep in my ears and the lowing of the oxen which I hear? And Saul said, They. Sounds like Eve and Adam. Well, they. Starts pointing at the people. They have brought out them from the Amalekites for the people. Deflection. The people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God. Not my God, your Samuel. That's why we did it. We did it again for a righteous reason. I held my tithe back because I want to serve you, God. 1,000 other examples of how we do this exact thing. They held it back to sacrifice to the Lord your God, and that the rest we have utterly destroyed. But we did this. But God, I've tithed in the... I mean, I'm just taking an example out of thin air. I've tithed in the past. You know, again, to kind of take that... what's the bank account so high for? I don't get it. You didn't really keep it up, did you? Again, this case, Saul made it right. He believed he did the right thing, but we have. He just knew God would want him to hold those so he could offer the best to God. He just knew that was what God wanted, and he acted accordingly. Then Samuel said, again, I think, perhaps a little mercifully, Samuel tells him to be quiet. I read this and say, Saul, stop talking. You don't know what you're doing. Stop. He says, be quiet, and I will tell you what the Lord said to me last night. And he said to him, speak on. I read this, still not aware. Not aware that, well, tell me what he said then. Think, yeah, we got all the stuff. We're going to offer it. We're good. Speak on. And again, before we leave, it says the Lord said it. Samuel's not making it up. He's not his opinion. It's not his assessment. The Lord said it. So Samuel said, when you were little in your own eyes, isn't that a wonderful, wonderful clue? When you were little in your own eyes, were you not head of the tribes of Israel? And did not the Lord anoint you king over Israel? Now the Lord sent you on a mission and said, go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are consumed. Why? It's a good start of a question. Why did you do it? Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you swoop down on the spoil and do evil in the sight of the Lord? Brethren, this, again, words and assessments from God, juxtaposed with the assessment of Saul, radically different. God's view of what Saul did is diametrically opposed to what Saul thought he was doing. Saul saying, I'm serving the Lord. After understanding clearly the command to destroy, he said, no, I got a better idea. And Saul said to Samuel, this is why I'm convinced up till now he is not at all understanding that he did what he did. He thinks he's right. Saul says to Samuel, but I have obeyed the voice of the Lord. But I did. He still is right. Even when confronted with the facts, even with the sheep and the oxen, and we'll see Agag here in a minute. He knows he's there. But I did do it. I did utterly destroy it. And gone on the mission on which the Lord sent me, and brought back Agag, king of Amalek. I have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people took the plunder, sheep and oxen, the best of things, which should have been utterly destroyed, to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal. He's reiterating his argument, but we did it for a righteous reason. So Samuel said, has the Lord as great a delight in burnt offerings and sacrifice as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness as the iniquity of idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king. Now on this advice, on this word, on this line, I think this is probably the turning point for Saul. Of course, it's strictly because, well, he's rejected you now. Whoa. He's rejected me? I'm king? He's rejecting me? He has rejected you from being king. Then Saul said to Samuel, I have sinned. Well, clearly I've sinned now because it's going to affect me today, right now, in front of all these people. I'm going to be embarrassed like that. I have sinned, for I have transgressed the commandment of the Lord and your words, because I feared the people and obeyed their voice. Now, therefore, please pardon my sin and return with me, that I may worship the Lord. But Samuel said to Saul, I will not return with you, for you have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel. And Samuel turned around to go away. Saul seized the edge of his robe and it tore. And Samuel said to him, the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to a neighbor of yours who is better than you. And also the strength of Israel will not lie or relent, for he is not a man that he should relent. I want to highlight that verse because it's the concept. It's going to come up again when we're in the New Testament. The strength of Israel. God will not lie. What you just heard is the truth, and I will not relent. There comes a time when God says, you're just not going to do it, are you? Sometimes the judgments of God have permanent consequences. And Saul was. His family, I mean, he could have established his family over Israel forever. He could have been the Davidic line. It's taken away from him because of who he was. Then Saul says it again. Then he said, I have sinned. I have sinned. But what does he want? Yet honor me now, please, before the elders and my people. and before Israel and return with me that I may worship the Lord your God. So Samuel turned back after Saul, and Saul worshiped the Lord. Again, we know it was many years before that actually happened, but the decision was made. There's, again, dozens and dozens of lessons I suppose we can glean from this. The one that I want us to focus again on is this man made it right in his head. And he is a man God said was a righteous man, chose him, handpicked. That's the one I want. Put him in charge. And again, we get sort of a little bit of a David mindset in there when he says, when you were little in your own eyes, weren't you? And I read that and I question myself, so I'll ask the question of everybody here. How many of us, when we were little in our own eyes, before we knew all the stuff we know, before we had all this understanding, before we knew prophecy and we were able to recite scriptures and we were able to do this, all this stuff, what did God do for us when we were little and we were hungry? We wanted to know the truth. We didn't come to services to another one and potluck, come on, man. We wanted to know. We spend time in the Bible. We spend time doing these things when we were little, in our own mind, in our own eyes. And didn't God bless us with that? Didn't we have understanding? Weren't we extended the favor of a living God? I do wonder how many of us, and again, I'm in this boat. I grew up in the church. Both my parents were baptized by the time I was born. I do wonder how many times we just get comfortable where we are. We're good because, well, I think I know as much as everybody else. I may know more than some of them. I don't know. And we do what Saul does. We make it okay. We start deciding how we want to do things. I want to take look at another servant that is probably on the other end of the spectrum, although confronted with a lot of the same thing, a lot of the same rationale. It's interesting to compare the responses, though. And again, let's jump forward to 2 Samuel chapter 12. You'll recognize this again as the story of David. A man that was fully convinced that he was all right in doing what he did with Bathsheba. Fully convinced, killing a man the way he did. Not a problem. Weeks, months, maybe longer, goes by between those events. And he's got apparently a very clean conscience about it. How do you do that? How do you go from seeing a woman, not looking away, taking her in, sleeping with her, having a child, killing a man, lying, and all the other stuff that goes around that, to a clean conscience about it? You deceive yourself. You make it okay. Another man, handpicked by God. In this case, again, we know the end of the story. A man truly after God's own heart. I want to pick the story up in 2 Samuel chapter 12. We'll start in verse 1. Then the Lord sent Nathan to David and said to him, and came to him, and he and said to him, there were two men in one city, one rich, one the other poor. The rich man had exceedingly many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb, which he had bought and nourished, and it grew up together with him and with his children. It ate of his own food and drank from his own cup and lay in his bosom, and it was like a daughter to him. And a traveler came to the rich man, who refused to take from his own flocks and from his herd to prepare one for the wayfaring man who had come to him. But he took the poor man's lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him. So David's anger was greatly aroused against the man. Again, I find this instructive. Of course, it's somewhat, different worlds. But even in a deceived state, he is able to look at somebody else that essentially did the same thing and get aroused to anger and pronounce the right judgment. I mean, that's a powerful thought. That we, just like David, can sit, believe we're okay, yet spot the exact same thing in our neighbor and condemn them for it and tell everybody else how bad they are. So David's anger was greatly aroused against the man. And he said to Nathan, "As the Lord lives, the man who has done this thing shall surely die." Again, I think that's a phenomenal assessment. And he's right. "And he shall restore fourfold for the lamb, because he did this thing, and because he had no pity." Then Nathan said to David, "You are the man. Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I anointed you king over Israel. I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave you your master's house, your master's wives into your keeping, and gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if that had been too little, I also would have given you much more." And here's the why question again. Why have you despised the commandment of the Lord to do evil in His sight? Why have you done this? "You have killed Uriah the Hittite with the sword. You have taken his wife to be your wife and have killed him with the sword of the people of Ammon." It's the same question in one sense. Why are you doing it? And I think that's the same question God asks of us all the time. It's a question I think we ought to ask when certain things are going on. Why is this going on? Why am I doing this? Why am I responding this way? Why are you? "Now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house, because you have despised me and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up and up adversity against you from your own house, and will take your wives before your eyes and give them to your neighbor, and he shall lie with your wives in the sight of the sun. For you did it in secretly, or in secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel, before the sun." I love Nathan's response. When he's confronted with it, when he becomes aware of it, juxtapose this with Saul's. "So David said to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord." In one sense, a lot of the same words. But you don't see, "But I didn't. But she shouldn't have been, I mean, you know, but I did do what the Lord said." That's Saul's response. And after, you know, several layers of trying to get below it, this is all David says. "I have sinned against the Lord." And Nathan said to David, "The Lord has also put away your sin. You shall not die." Justification. David could have stood there and justified most all of his actions. She shouldn't have been up where I could see her. And I mean, after all, I'm a guy, I'm, you know, young at this point. I couldn't resist. I had to. I mean, come on. Well, once I found out and she was pregnant, we had to do all this stuff, for the nation's sake, I had to get rid of this other guy. The nation would have had, you, God, would have had a black mark had we let this go. All the nations around, I mean, all the justification he could have come up with, didn't do it. There were no different, there were no extenuating circumstances why it was okay this time. He simply said, "I sinned." There are many examples we could take a look at. Many of the great servants of God have this mindset, and the reaction to it, their response to it, largely dictates the outcome. Consider Job. Again, we're not going to go there and read it. We're all familiar with the stories, especially the two ends of the book. A man that God, again, said, "Have you considered my servant Job? A righteous man." Satan's like, "Yeah, he is. He's righteous. But that's only, you know, he would turn from you if you protect," and all this type of stuff. I mean, if you read the first part, Job was one of these guys that would offer sacrifices for his children and his daughters and sons-in-law, just in case they sinned and they didn't know it. I mean, that's a man that is dedicated to God. And we know the story. There was something he needed to see. He thought he was right. He was doing everything he could right. And in the end, he says, now I see. Now I see what you wanted me to see. He would never have come to that on his own. Consider the Pharisees. In their minds, they were right. They were honorable. They were doing the right thing. They were serving God. They were upholding the line. It was this Jesus guy that was breaking everything and teaching other people to do it. They weren't doing that because they knew they were wrong. It was this other guy. Jesus' assessment is they were whitewashed tombs. Maybe that was John. Whitewashed tombs. John, what about Christ's inner circle? John and all the apostles. Again, we're probably leading up to Passover, went over these scriptures, so they're all familiar to us. Essentially, we'll stand with you, Christ. We will be that. We will not cave. I'm going to stand with you no matter what. I'll die for you. When the time comes, they all run. They all forsook him. And they believed. I mean, I don't think you read that thinking in the back of that. It's like, dude, the minute Roman soldier shows up, I'm out of here. That's not what they're thinking. They really believe they're going to stand with him. They don't believe they'll run when the time comes. Just like no cadet going into the military thinks he's the one that's going to be the yellow belly and run the other way. We focus on the hubris of John. It's extraordinarily interesting that after the events, if you recall the scene when they're walking on the beach and Christ is resurrected and they've been out fishing, he brings them in, they have their meal and they're walking on the beach. And Christ starts to ask him, do you agape me? Do you have godly love for me? It's very instructive because now we see a John that says, you know, I filio you. I have brotherly love for you. You know I have that. I think it's interesting because I read into that he understands, do you have godly love for me? And he's like, I don't know if I can say that. I thought I did. But I know I have brotherly love for you. So I'll answer it that way. And he asked him three times. He got the same answer three times. I think it's actually a healthier mindset. As opposed, you know I have godly love for you. We could look at Paul. That's a striking example. A man that was willing to walk around and kill people in the name of God, in the name of his religion, believing he was doing God a service, and afterwards realizes he was totally wrong. But he was right. He simply was right. I want to take a look at a little bit of Christ's teachings. And I think if you approach many of the parables, much of the teachings of Christ, this theme dominates his teachings and dominates his time on this earth. Obviously, it's woven into a lot of other instruction too. But this theme is found in so many of the parables. In fact, there is a word. There is a word that only Christ uses. Nowhere else. It's a Greek word, so nowhere else in the Bible / New Testament will you find this word used by Christ. And it is used in almost every case, looking to people, talking to people, talking to the religious groups, those who believed they were serving God, those who believed they were the ones holding the spiritual line. The religious elite, if you will, of the day. It is used 20 times. 15 of them are in Matthew. The majority of those are in one chapter. We won't read the chapter, but we'll read a parable that's part of the same discourse, essentially, day apart. Most of them are found in Matthew 23. The word in Greek is hupokrites. Hupokrites. And it means an actor, a stage player, a dissembler, a pretender. And we know the word is hypocrite. I find it instructive that only Christ uses the word. The righteous judge. in the totality of the Bible. He's the only one that's looking people in the eye and saying, you are a hypocrite. I know you think you're doing the right thing. I know it. I get it. He's telling them, you're a hypocrite. Because you're not. You're not what you think you are. Again, we all know those, you hypocrites. Scribes, Pharisees. Read Matthew 23. It's instructive with this in mindset. Or in your mind. I want to jump, as I mentioned, to sort of the end of this discourse. I believe it's a day apart, but very close to the time when he's talking about the hypocrites. Matthew 25 contains a parable. You know, sometimes I prepare messages and I'm thinking, oh man, they've heard all these before. We've heard this one. If you've been in the church any length of time, probably 5-10 times a year, so add them up. You probably heard this one, studied it. But again, the instruction is so valuable. Matthew 25, verse 24 is the parable of the talents. We're going to break into the story just so we don't need to read it all. But again, we're all familiar with it. A lot of talents handed out. Then he who had received the one talent came and said, again, where is this man's mind? What is he thinking? He who received the one talent came and said, like Saul, Lord, I'm here. I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you have not sown, gathering where you have not scattered. First of all, the man is deceived on his image of what God is, what the master is like. That being the case, he's coming proudly saying, God, I've got what you gave me. In our world, God, here's the truth. I got it. It's all here. I protected it. I defended it. I am so glad to be able to give you what you gave me. Here, I saw the preciousness of it. It is valuable. It's gold to me. I protected it. I defended it. I defended it with my life. I held on to it. I never lost. Obviously, I'm injecting my own thoughts into this. But that's the way I read it. We have a man here that is deceived not only of his image of God, but of what the master expected. For reference purposes, Luke 19:22, it says, out of your own mouth I will judge you, you wicked servant, referring to the same guy. So again, little perceptions, completely wrong. Yet, Lord, I'm here. While the master was gone, did he not have time to flee? If he knew he was a wicked servant, could he not have run? Could he not have went into exile? Especially if he had any indication of the results. Nobody would come saying, Master, here's everything you got. If you know the penalty is death, you're going to get out of there. I think he thought he was delivering a pretty good report. Verse 25, and I was afraid and went and hid your talent in the ground. Look, there you have what is yours. Verse 26, but the Lord answered and said to him, you wicked and lazy servant, you knew that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed. Again, God's essentially saying, all right, that's your assessment of me. I'll take you up on it. We'll judge you, as we read back in Luke. We'll judge you by your own words. And he says, you're a wicked and you're a lazy servant. I think there was a little bit of surprise. A little bit of, really? Me? But I have obeyed the voice of the Lord. I've utterly destroyed the mountain. I have done it. I kept what you gave me. Why are you, you wicked and lazy servant. So you ought to have deposited my money with the bankers, and at my coming I would have received back my own with interest. Therefore, take the talent from him and give it to him who has 10 talents. For to everyone who has, more will be given, and he will have abundance. But for him who does not have, even what he has will be taken away. And cast the unprofitable servant into outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. See, brethren, the servant with the one denarius saw the value. Got it. saw the preciousness of it, saw that it was worth protecting. All the while, had a completely wrong view of what his master expected. Another parable found over in Luke. Luke chapter 13. I know for those in Nashville, this one's been brought up a few times over the last 4 or 5 months. I know I used it a while back. But again, so very instructive. So very instructive. And one of them that honestly strikes a very, very healthy fear within me. I read this and hopefully it's a godly fear, I guess, is all I'll say. Luke 13, we'll start in verse 23. Then one said to him, Lord, are there few who are saved? And he said to them, strive to enter through the narrow gate, for many, I say to you, will seek to enter and will not be able. When once the master of the house has risen up and shut the door, and you begin to stand outside and knock at the door, saying, Lord, Lord, open to us. And he will answer and say to you, I do not know you. Where are you from? Brethren, he is not talking to atheists. He is not talking to Muslims. He is not talking to Hindus, Shinto, Taoist. He's talking to his people. He's talking to people that know to be in the house. He's talking to people that know to come and say, Lord, Lord. He's not talking to somebody that just has no clue, has never even heard, or has no concept of what Jesus Christ did for us and what the end of this age is going to look like. He's talking to people that knew they should have been in the house. Those who profess to know him. Those who profess to have a relationship, saying, but Lord, I know you. People who in their mind believe they're in the house and should be granted entrance anytime they're ready. Again, I'm not sure why they're on the outside of the house, but in the parable, that's where they are. These are people that want in. And they want in because they have knowledge. They have understanding. They have a certain perception that they ought to be in the room. Then you will begin to say, we ate and drank in your presence, and you taught in our streets. Again, but we've been with you so long. We've been to every service. We've been to every holy day. We've been to, But we did all this, and we listened to everything you had to say. I mean, essentially they're going to proclaim we did everything we knew to do. I mean, this is honestly quite an admission, because you see a certain sincerity there. I think you can read a sincerity. But we did this, Lord. How many of us have socialized? How many, and I don't mean to say us. These are questions I ask myself. I usually put the I in here. Do we do this? Do we hear the words? Faithfully attend Sabbath, holy days, tithes, etc., all. And then sit secure because we do those things and stop growing. It would be analogous to a member of Israel walking through the wilderness toward the promised land for those 40 years, saying, I'm done. I'm just going to sit right here. And thinking it's okay. Believing it's right. Our journey isn't over until you draw your last breath. It's just not. And we cannot stop. Verse 27, but he will say, I tell you, I do not know you. Where are you from? Depart from me, all you workers of iniquity. workers of iniquity. By nature, iniquity is believing you're doing it right. Yet you're working the wrong things. I don't know you. They're saying to Christ, I know you. But he's saying, I don't know you. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And you, when you see Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and all the prophets in the kingdom of God, and you yourself thrust out. Brethren, with this parable in mind, with this idea that we've been developing in mind, have I constructed a worldview in my mind, in our minds, that allows, I've worded this as me, so I'll put it in the first person. Have I constructed a worldview in my mind that allows me to labor under the opinion that compliance with the law is knowing God? I think that's a solid question that we all ought to ask. Do we have a worldview in our minds? And have we justified it? We said, listen, if I just do this, I'm complying across the board. I'm hearing everything you're saying. I'm doing it all. Do we, in our own mind, build up a bulwark, build up a defense that allows us to sit securely behind massively thick walls, if you will, secured in our own mind that we're doing everything. Therefore, we know our God. I think there's a difference. I think this parable and many of these things illustrate that there is a difference. Consider the difference, again, between David and Saul. In the Psalms, we get a rich inset in, or view into David's mind. He says, I put God always before me. I seek His face. He is my God. I meditate on His law. It is righteous. It changes. I mean, this is David. Saul, within his own mind, sought compliance. Come sacrifice with me, your God. Come do these things. And I'm good. In Saul's case, it was mixed with a little self-promotion. But essentially, he wanted to comply. And he was okay in his mind. Both these parables, and I mean, there were dozens we took out, or I took out. Both these parable ends with the phrase, weeping and gnashing of teeth. Every place that is used in Scripture, it's an interesting study. In every case, the disciples were present. Most of them, he's only talking to his disciples. Do we understand that, brethren? We are that group. We are the same group. We join the same group. We are part of his disciples. Five places out of seven, the only group present was his disciples. In one place, he had a multitude, but they were followers, just wasn't labeled as a disciple. In the final case, the Pharisees were there and the chief priests were there, but so were his disciples. I would conclude from that that it's not unreasonable to think, and even in the case where others were present, he was predominantly talking to his disciples. And in every one of those cases, you got the mindset and the idea of what you think is not the reality. What about us, brethren? What about us? What about the church as a whole, as it is pictured at the end of the age, which I truly believe we are near? We may all be in the grave, especially some of us that are getting up there in years. And we know, I mean, I was one of these kids that always thought, I used to be worried that I wouldn't have enough life before Christ's return. You know, I want to get married, have kids, and you know. I was always worried that Christ would return too soon for that to happen. Now I'm like, oh man, I hope he hurries up. So I get it. Somebody's going to be in that generation. What about us? Because you see, I suppose we could say, we could do exactly what we're talking about today. And we could say, but it's different. We're in a different situation. We're different than all of them. Most of the people you just mentioned, they didn't have God's Spirit with them. Oh, it may have been with them, but you know, since Pentecost, it's in us differently. The disposition and dispensation of God is slightly different. I don't know if Saul had it or not. I mean, we could begin to rationalize that and say, but that was Saul. I mean, that was then. That, you know, he's got armies around him. He's doing things. It's all different now. They were not in a general community of believers. They were not in a group that could help me out. They were not in a group that has sort of largely established doctrine. If you think about it, that's a phenomenal thing. There's not huge doctrinal debate. There's marginal and fringe differences. But it hasn't been largely established. They're not part of a church. They're not part of a group. They're not part of... We got a lot of people here. If I start getting too far out of line, surely somebody will come and tell me, you know, we're different. They didn't have the canonized Word of God. They didn't have access to tens of thousands of sermons on the internet. All good. Not all of them, but good ones are out there. They didn't have access to millions of pages of writings and scholars and works and thousands of years. We've had 2,000 years for men to come up with books. And there's a lot of good ones out there. Surely we're different because we have all that. We have scientific evidence. They didn't have that. We conceived from creation and be instructed by it. David was a little bit, but we do know more. It's fair to say. I don't think David got to look at subatomic particles and figure out what's inside a quark and then figure out what's inside and then get down to what they're calling a God particle, hoping they can find it. They didn't have all that. We have more availability, more information than all of them had. Is it possible, brethren, that the view we hold of ourselves as a result is not the same that Christ holds? I want to ask another question. Again, I'll stop here. Sidebar. If you don't take anything else away from this message, please take away the idea that it's possible. And then get with God and ask Him what He thinks. He is a loving God and will reveal it. So if we consider that it's possible, even though we have all this stuff, we got it all. We are spiritually rich, if you will. What if Christ came down here, materialized behind me here, after He resuscitated me from a heart attack? What if He stood here and told you exactly what it would be like at the end time? What if He came down and said, this is the environment you will be in. This is what you're going to have to face. And He's telling all of us here what that's going to be like. And not necessarily picking out individuals and not political. He's talking about the environment within His church. He's not going to tell you who's going to be the next president. He's not going to tell you how Europe's going to go or whatever. He's just going to say, this is the environment you as a church, you as a member of My body will have to exist in. Well, thankfully, He has already given that to us. He's already given it to us. Turn to Revelation chapter 3. Revelation chapter 3, we're going to start in verse 14. I know when you get into this, there's about 30 different views on this. I ask you to consider that one way of looking at it, a valid way, is a chronological event, a chronological mood, if you will. And if you look at this, none of them does Christ say specifics. He just gives you the environment He tells you what it's going to be like. And this is the last church. This is the last age before the return of Christ. So if on one hand we say, we believe we're living in the last days, yet on the other hand we say, well, it's impossible for this to be the environment that I exist in, because after all, I've got 10,000 sermons. I got a terabyte of drive space here with all this stuff on it. And I've listened to most of whatever we're saying. They don't mix. This is the final church. Revelation 3, starting in verse 14. And to the angel of the church of Laodicea write, these things says the Amen, the faithful, the true witness, the beginning of the creation of God. Important line. The truth. This is the truth. This is the one that has the honest assessment. Not his people. Not the predominant thought at the end of the age. He's saying, I know. Just like he told the Pharisees. I know what the truth is. I know your works, that you are neither hot nor cold. I wish that you were hot or cold. Then, because you are lukewarm and neither hot nor cold, I will vomit you out of my mouth. And here's the operative phrase I want to focus on. But because you say, because in your own assessment, this is what you are saying. This is what the church, before Christ comes, will be saying. Again, I want to emphasize, this is not saying every individual within the church. Sometimes I think we look at it, and that's why nobody wants to admit that maybe we're in the Laodicean era. I don't know. I'm not the judge. I'm just saying it's possible. God's not saying every single member is Laodicean. Every single member, every single person is a lukewarm person. He's just saying that's the environment you're in. Because you say, it's their assessment. This is what they're saying in their head, in their heart. I am rich. I am spiritually rich. I've got my 10,000 sermons. I'm rich and have become wealthy and I have need of nothing. And you do not know that you are wretched, miserable, poor, blind, and naked. This is their assessment juxtaposed with God's assessment. This is what he's saying. You're saying, I've got all this. And we do, brethren. You cannot listen to all the messages. You can't listen. I don't think you can get through all the ones just United puts out. Much less the other groups. They're all great messages. I know you can't read the internet. I know you can't get through the 2.3 million hits when you type in certain Christian-based words. We have more. We are rich. I mean, consider this. The people in here didn't have even this, much less all that stuff we just talked about on the net or in libraries or in thousands of other places. Many of them were on their own. They didn't have a community. But Christ says, you're wretched, miserable, poor, blind, and naked. Verse 18, I counsel you to buy of me gold refined in the fire, that you may be rich. He's giving some advice here. I want you to be rich, but you got to come to the source. In the last few minutes of this message, we're going to focus on that source because we're not left wanting, brethren. But again, we do have to consider it's possible. I counsel you to buy of me gold refined in the fire, that you may be rich, and white garments, that you may be clothed, that the shame of your nakedness may not be revealed, and anoint your eyes with eye salve, that you may see. He's saying you're blind. I put the eye salve on so you can actually see. As many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. Therefore, be zealous and repent. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in to him and dine with him and he with me. What kind of church has Christ on the outside knocking to get in? I think he's defined it. That's a church that thinks they already have him. They don't need him in. This is a church that thinks they don't need it. And again, I think it's also instructive. He shifts here a little bit. General environment. Now he gets specific. He says, if anyone opens the door, I will come into him and I will dine with him and he with me. Brethren, you can open the door. And I pray and hope that I'm preaching to the choir and this doesn't matter. That the door is wide open and that Christ is dwelling here right now in the hearts and minds of every one of you. But consider that it may not be. Consider there may be more in our life. That's what these days picture. Our journey, our walk from slavery to freedom and membership in the family of God. The journey isn't over. It's not. Consider that there is more. To him who overcomes, I will grant to sit with me on my throne. And I, as I also overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. Brethren, I contemplate the numerous examples given in the Bible. I consider the parables that Christ gave. The words of Jeremiah echo through the mind that the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? I see the current state of affairs in our present day church. And when I say church, I'm talking about my entire life. I've watched it over and over and over and over and over and over and over. If you take all of them, take the top 10, think about it. We may have, and this is just back of the napkin addition in my head. If we take the top 10 splits from worldwide, we may have 30,000 people. At one point worldwide, I heard a number over 150,000. I consider the affairs in the present day church, all the fragments, all the individuals that have justified, made their decisions right. Every single one of them was right. Every one of them. I'm right. It's just the way it is. We're right. And brethren, especially this time of year, I contemplate my own mind and my own heart. I suppose preparing this message over the last 6 weeks or so has perhaps shed a little more light on it than would otherwise have been there. But it is amazing how many times I reframe arguments. Something will come up, and in the back of your head, you're like, yeah, okay. But within a fraction of a second, I've recrafted the argument and said, no, but this is the way it was. I'm right. And it's not always in the big things. It's the, you come home, maybe you are actually a little grumpy. You come in, you're a little curt with your family. And they say, what's wrong? Well, nothing. I'm fine. And we shift. We do it all the time. Again, in contemplating my own life, I find repeatedly justifying my actions. Justifying because why? I want to be right, and I want to do what I want to do. I am left then to conclude that blindness in part has happened to us all. All of us. I am also left to conclude that we simply need a judge for our own life that is bigger than all of us combined. This then is the antidote. This is the answer. This is the only source, just like we read in Revelation. It is the only true judge. I want to read the verses that are around verse we've just quoted several times. Turn back, if you would, to Jeremiah 17, verse 5. There's two different groups that are talked about leading up to the verse, again, verse 9, that we all have committed, I believe, to memory. The cursed and the blessed. Verse 5 says, "Thus says the Lord, cursed is the man who trusts in the Lord and makes flesh his strength, whose heart departs from the Lord. For he shall be like a shrub in the desert and shall not see when good comes. But he shall inhabit the parched places, in the wilderness, in the sand land, or in the salt land, which is not inhabited." This is a man that is cursed. Why? Because he trusts in the flesh. He trusts in his own judgment. He trusts in his own minds. And we are promoted. That is the society we are in. The elevation of the individual. You're right because you think it. God says you're cursed if you trust in flesh. And whose heart, lest we think this is only applying to physical strength, his heart departs from the Lord. Blessed, verse 7, blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord and whose hope is in the Lord. For he shall be like a tree planted by the waters, which spreads out his roots by the river. He will not fear when heat comes, but its leaves will be green, and will not be anxious in the year of drought, nor will cease from yielding fruit. In the verse we all know, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? And again, in this case, he reiterates the antidote. Verse 10, the Lord searches the hearts. Or it says, I, the Lord, search the heart. I test the minds, even to give to every man according to his way, according to the fruit of his doings. That's the answer, brethren. Go to your God. If we can remember, if we can all sort of agree that it's possible, then we have to take this step. We have to get on our knees and say, God, I know you see something I don't see. I know you are the righteous judge. Here's what I'm thinking. Is this right? And a loving God, I guarantee you, he wants to answer that question. He doesn't want you in the dark. But I think he wants you to ask it. Turn, if you would, very quickly. In fact, you don't have to turn there. I'll just read them and I'll not make any comments. We'll just get through this. I think it's important. I want to go back and just give you a little glimpse into the heart and mind of David with what we just read in mind again. Psalms 139, it starts out this way. A psalm of David. O Lord, you have searched me and know me. You know my sitting down, my rising up. You understand my thoughts afar off. You comprehend my path, my lying down, and are acquainted with all my ways. For there is not a word on my tongue, but behold, O Lord, you know it altogether. You have hedged me behind and before, and laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain it. This is David. Lord, you know me. This is how he's opening up this psalm. Jump down if you're taking notes. I would encourage you to read the whole psalm. For this sake, I'm going to drop down to verse 23, the last part of the psalm. So we're going to bookend this one a little bit. With that in mind, he says this at the end. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxieties and see if there is a wicked way in me and lead me in the way everlasting. David is not saying, God, I am so good. I am so righteous. I have these 10,000 sermons after all. I've listened to them all. He's not saying, and I don't think you can find it, but if you can, let me know. He's saying as we let out, you know me. You are the one. You're the faithful, true witness. Tell me, show me what you see that I don't see. Show me where I'm not what you want me to be. Show me. That's what this walk is about. It's our journey. Today pictures the end, if you will. Today pictures this, knowing your God and Him knowing you. What did the parable say? He said it. I don't know you. One more psalm. It's a short one. Psalm 26. Same kind of mindset. Vindicate me, O Lord, for I have walked in my integrity. I have also trusted in the Lord. I shall not slip. Examine me, O Lord, and prove me. Try my mind and my heart. Again, I wish I could read the rest of this, but I'll try to respect our time because I'm sure everybody's getting a little hungry too. Please read that whole psalm. Try my mind. I have heard it said years ago. I haven't heard it in a long time. But it used to be said very commonly, don't ever ask God to do this. Don't, because I've heard it said, you would just crumble and you would commit suicide or something if you actually knew this. Lord, I knew you to be a harsh God. Reaping where you, I have this, that's a wrong image of our God. He wants to reveal it. And do you believe, if you, with all transparency, with all authenticity, come and say, God, please examine me, O Lord. Prove me. Try my mind and my heart. Do you believe a loving God would do something to harm you? It's absurd. A loving God will, in His own measured way, correctly, lovingly, show you. This, brethren, is knowing God. This is having that relationship. This is what this season pictures. This started with the Passover. This is your walk. When it's done, can we say, I know you? More importantly, can he say he knows us? This is going to be it. Brethren, I pray and ask us all to make this year the year we commit or recommit. It doesn't matter where you are. I guarantee you there is more. Simply because you're still alive, if for no other reason. And we also all have a pretty good insight into the human condition. None of us are perfect. There is more. There is more to know about our God than you will ever get in this life. Don't stop. Let's make this year the year we commit to letting Christ live in your lives fully. I hope and pray everyone can read Psalm 26 and pray that almost verbatim with all sincerity before your God. Yes, if we do this, yes, He will show you things about your life you did not know. Yes, you will need the courage and the honesty to confront them. Yes, you may need to have some very difficult conversations. Yes, it may be painful. Yes, it may be difficult. Yes, it may be humbling. Yes, you may shed some tears in the process. But brethren, the alternative is to simply go no further in your relationship with Christ than where you are right now. That's the alternative, to stay where you are, firmly believing you're okay. Believing, trusting in your own assessment and your own judgment that you're okay and you're fine. The alternative, brethren, is to remain in the warm, shallow waters of a superficial relationship. And not discover the boundless depths of what it means to know Christ.